Prophecy is a way in which God proves himself. There's no question about that. We find throughout the entire Scripture, Old and New Testament, many, many prophecies. And I think prophecies are important, and we know that they are interesting. I think the main reason why they're interesting to each one of us is because we feel we may be living in the period when many of the prophecies are going to take place. I know for a fact that the time of the end is getting closer. We all know that by each day that goes by. I'm not talking from that point of view, but I mean it's getting closer because of what we are seeing happening in the world today. We have been saying at the foundation for a long time, watch the Middle East. Watch the Middle East. The revival of the Middle East is very essential for the fulfillment of many prophecies in the Scripture. There are too many people, in my judgment, that are focusing their prophetic understanding on Europe, or interpretation, I should say, on Europe, on Rome, on Germany, on Great Britain, and the United States, as far as that goes. But you know, the center of prophecy is the Middle East. And I don't believe that there's any of us that cannot see something happening there which begins to show the Bible, or the prophecies of the Bible, begin to fit into place a little bit more. So I think that God does prove himself through prophecy. Certainly he is going to. And the reason it's so interesting to us is because many of us may be living in the very time that some of those prophecies are speaking about. Now, there are all types of prophecies in the Bible. Most of the prophecies are what scholars call space prophecies. Space prophecies. These types of prophecies are those which are given like in Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, some of the minor prophets. Even the New Testament has certain space prophecies in which no time is given for their fulfillment. No time. It just says something like, in that day something is going to happen, or in that day there, or whatever. But it really doesn't pinpoint the exact time. These are called space prophecies, and the majority of the prophecies of the Bible are of that type. This is one of the reasons why so much difficulty can come along in the interpretation of them, because no one knows exactly the time when they will occur. That's why we need other types of prophecies. Prophecies that are known as time prophecies. Now, I just talked about space prophecies, that's the majority, but we also need to have time prophecies. There are time prophecies in the New Testament, notably in the book of Revelation. But most time prophecies are found in the book of Daniel. Now, if you can get the time of events at the end of the age straightened out, then you can take the space prophecies and maybe hook them in on the time schedule and come to a better understanding of prophetical interpretation. But there is another type of prophecy, and this is the type I'm going to speak about today. This type of prophecy is known as prophecies by design, or design prophecies. Now, let me interpret what I mean by this term. Design prophecies are these. It's how prophetic themes or books of the Bible relate to one another through design or positioning of books one to another. Now, when you take a prophecy in Isaiah, it might be three or four sentences long. You have to associate it sometimes with another three or four sentences, or maybe a chapter in some other place, hook them onto a time schedule, and maybe you have an understanding. Okay, but the thing is, what I'm talking about today is not prophecies found just within a single book, but prophecies that are found within various books which are designed in a particular way, in a prophetic way, to show teaching, prophetic teaching. Now, who is it that designed the Old and the New Testament? Well, most scholars would say the ones who canonized those books. And as far as the Old Testament is concerned, and I'm going to talk only today about Old Testament prophecies, though I will come into the New Testament in a few places with them, but the Old Testament canonizers were those priests who lived in the 5th and 4th centuries before the birth of Christ. And tradition tells us, and I think this is pretty reliable, that the one who was really in charge of canonizing the Old Testament, taking various books which had been written in former times, starting with those of Moses and others, David, Solomon, so forth, and then putting them together into a particular design, which we call the Old Testament, the man who was more responsible for that than anyone else was Ezra the priest. Ezra. He had helpers. The helpers were known as sopharim, scribes. They're mentioned also in the Old Testament. And tradition makes it quite clear that it was this Ezra, who lived in the 5th century before the birth of Christ, who finally, with his helpers, put together the Old Testament. Now, the Old Testament is not in the design that we have it in our King James Version today. That is, the way that it came from Ezra was in a different position. In the last, or rather I should say in the January commentator, I showed there what the traditional, or I should say the canonical, order of the books really should be. And they're in three divisions. The law, first five books of the Bible are called the law. That's one division. The prophets is another division, really of six books. Some people call them eight, but really six books. And you get five and six make 11 books. And then the third division is called the division of the writings. Christ himself called it the division of the Psalms. But he only called it that because the Psalms was the book which introduced this third division of books. They are 11 in number. 11 books in number. All of these 11 books of the third division have something to do with royalty or government. That is why in ancient times, even before the time of Christ, these books in the third division, these 11 books, were called the royal books or ruler books, books dealing with government. And I'm going to talk today about five particular books that are in that third division, and indeed smack dab in the middle of the third division, which on the surface you would think would have very little prophetic information in it at all. But when you really analyze it from the point of view of design prophecies, you will find that these five little books, which all go together, and they were all read in the temple at particular times, ordained by Ezra the priest under divine inspiration, when you put them all together, these five books, they tell a prophetic story which is outstanding and indeed very informative. I would say that if a person could understand the prophetic design of these five little books called the Megillot, that's the Hebrew name for them. That simply means festival books because they were designed to be read at particular festivals. The first one was to be read at Passover. The second was to be read at Pentecost. The third, the middle one, was to be read on the anniversary of the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem in the 6th century B.C. At the same time, the temple was destroyed in 70 A.D. This is on the 10th day of the month of Ab in the summertime. The month of Ab is the 5th month of the Hebrew year. And a particular book was to be read on that day. I'll mention what it is in just a few minutes. The next book was to be read at the Feast of Tabernacles period, and then the fifth book at a time called the Feast or the Period of Purim. I don't know how many of us know very much about the Feast of Purim, but it's certainly mentioned in the Bible. It's mentioned in the book of Esther. And the book of Esther, by the way, is the book that was read in the temple at the anniversary of the Purim festival. The Purim festival is always held in the month prior to Nisan, in the late wintertime, in the month just prior to Passover, and indeed about 1 month prior to Passover. That's when Purim was actually held. And these five books were books to be read in the temple at these particular times, starting with Passover and going all the way through to Purim, mentioned here in the Old Testament. Now let's put those time periods up here on the board. Passover first. We have next Pentecost, followed by Ab 10. Ab is the fifth month of the year, and as I said before, in the Old Testament, this day was the time for the anniversary of the destruction of the temple in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. It also happened to be the exact time that the Romans destroyed the temple by accident, you might say, in 70 A.D. I'll come back to the significance of that in a few moments. That's Ab number 10, 10th day of Ab, the fifth month, in the summertime. It answers to about our August, in actual fact. The next was Tabernacles period. A book was read there. And then finally, at the Purim period, which is late winter, a month prior to Passover. Here are the five festival periods that were used for these books to be read And these books, the ones I'm going to mention now on the side, were the particular books associated with these periods. For example, Passover was the Song of Solomon. Pentecost was Ruth. Abtin, that is the anniversary of the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem, Lamentations. Tabernacles was Ecclesiastes, and then Purim was Esther, the book that mentions Purim itself, Esther. These five books right here were on one long scroll to be read in the temple services each year at these times. Song of Solomon was read at the beginning of the Passover season and was to be in association with Passover. The theme of Passover was illustrated in Song of Solomon. Ruth was to be read on Pentecost, and when you analyze Ruth here, you will see that it really does have late springtime significance. Lamentations with the 10th of Ab, and Lamentations, a song, which it is a song, a dirge, a type of lamentation about the destruction of Jerusalem, and it's most fitting that it be associated with Ab 10, the date for the anniversary of the destruction of the temple, the two temples. Ecclesiastes, people have wondered why in the world it's associated with tabernacles. I'll show it very briefly in just a few moments. Esther is associated with Purim, and most people could understand why that was the case. And it's certainly the theme of Purim. Now, it's most interesting, and I'll point this out right at first, that of the two books in the Bible that do not mention in any way, plainly mention, the word God or Lord or anything referring to deity, it's the first book of the Megillot and the last book of the Megillot. It is quite true that the Song of Songs does not mention the word God once. You would never realize that the book should ever, you would think, be included in a divine canon from the point of view that God is not even mentioned. And here it is, a book of the Bible. But God is not mentioned in Esther either. Not once, that is, plainly. Some people have felt that his name was in there cryptically about five different times through acrostical design, but that is rather difficult to prove. But you will not find in Esther the name of God once. You will find references to him to a certain extent because they fasted for 3 days, and obviously if they're going to fast, they're fasting, you know, to God. But you do not find God's name at the beginning of the Megillot, nor at the end of the Megillot. Some people may wonder why that is. Perhaps I can give a reason as we go on. Of course, in the middle books here, Ruth, Lamentations, and Ecclesiastes, God's name is mentioned. The Song of Songs is associated with Passover. And I'll tell you, there is a prophetic theme going through, from Song, through Ruth, through Lamentations, through Ecclesiastes, and Esther. And since these were written, or to be read, in a one-year period, beginning with the first of Israel's festivals, going to the last, which is Purim here, which is only for the Jews, that's quite true. But when you put the whole thing together, you get a prophetic theme coming out that has been placed there by the canonizers of the Old Testament themselves, notably by Ezra the priest. And you know, if you find Ezra under divine inspiration ordering these books to be read at particular times, to be in association with the meaning of these festivals, it shows that there must be some significance to them. And indeed, there is a tremendous significance. This is called prophecy by design, in which all books, lots of books, are coming in to give a story. Now, as far as Passover is concerned, it had the Song of Solomon always associated with it. And one theme, one book interprets the other. And really what we have to see is that since Passover is the first festival of the ancient Israelite year, we find that in the springtime, you would probably find that the Song of Solomon has some kind of a theme that would be associated with this springtime occurrence. And indeed, that's exactly what we have. Let's turn now to the Song of Solomon, which is just before the book of Isaiah. And we'll take a look at this theme, which we find in the Song of Solomon itself. Now, remember, the name of God is not found therein. And some people have said the only reason it finds its way into the Bible here is because it's to be symbolically interpreted as something in a certain way. But in an actual way, it's not to be understood. However, I think it could be comprehended in both ways. There's excellent, beautiful, physical love teaching found in the Song of Solomon. But there's also, I feel, a great deal of symbolic, spiritual teaching, even though God's name is not mentioned in it once. I think we can see it if we associate it with Passover. Now, in the Song of Songs, you'll read the first chapter and the introduction. I won't go into it in great detail, but it gives you all of a sudden a springtime theme. When you go into chapter 2, and I hope you've all turned to it by now, chapter 2 and beginning in verse 11, here you get the actual length, the actual year time being given, and you can see why it's associated with Passover from this point of view alone. Verse 11, "For lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of the singing of birds is come, the voice of the turtle dove, is heard in our land. The fig tree puts forth her green figs, and the vines with tender grape give a good smell. Arise, my love, be my fair one, and come away." From here on, the theme is that of springtime. Look at verse 15. It speaks about the tender grapes. In verse 16 of the same chapter, about he feedeth among the lilies. And the lily, of course, is a springtime flower associated with Passover, or we say Easter today. And here it is in the Song of Solomon. Going on throughout chapter 3, 4, and 5, this theme is continued. Let's go on to chapter 6, verse 2. It speaks about feed in the gardens and to gather the lilies. Verse 3, I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He feedeth among the lilies. There again, a springtime scene. And going on into chapter 6, verse 11, it speaks about the vine beginning to flourish and the pomegranates beginning to bud. The budding of the pomegranates. Chapter 7, verse 12, let us get up early to the vineyards. Let us see the vine flourish. That means the flowers come on. Whether the tender grape appear, that is in the springtime, and the pomegranates bud forth, there will I give you my love. It goes on to speak about mandrakes and new fruits, new and old fruits, which will be there in the springtime. Now, right at the very end, however, in chapter 8 and verse 8, this is a love story, and this love story between Solomon and this woman and the daughters of Jerusalem. It's very beautiful and all of that. But right at the very end, it talks about a little sister of this person that is being discussed here, this woman. It says in verse 8, we have a little sister. She hath no breast. By this means, of course, she's just a young girl. What shall we do for our sister in the day when she shall be spoken of? Now, in verse 9, this woman that's doing the talking here says that she is herself mature. Verse 10 is where it says, I am a wall, going on with another description showing that she is mature and all of that. But she's wondering about her little sister. And in verse 11, it closes by saying, Solomon hath a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He let out the vineyard unto keepers. Every one of the fruit thereof was to bring 1,000 pieces of silver. My vineyard, which is mine, is before me. Thou, O Solomon, must have 1,000, produce many, many thousands of things. And those that keep the fruit thereof, 200. He's going to apportion out to the keepers certain things, certain monies, for the keeping of his property. Thou that dwellest in the gardens, the companion, hark to thy voice, cause me to hear it. Make haste, my beloved, and be thou like to the roe or to the young hart upon the mountains of spices. Now that ends it. What I have done is just skimmed it. I haven't really given any major treatment to it, except to show that it's in the springtime. But now let us look at something, which I think is very important. I said that the name of God is not found in it. That's quite true. It's a love story between a man and a woman, between more than one man and other women here. It talks about virgins and them becoming married and so forth. It's a love story that leads to marriage. The whole story, really, up to chapter 8, is talking about this one woman in particular coming in contact with Solomon and someone she loves very much. He's called the bridegroom. The bridegroom is found in this coming out, time and time again. It's a springtime setting. And it's associated with Passover. Now, Passover is the first feast of the year that went to ancient Israel. And Passover was the feast that showed them how they were to come out of Egypt, have protection from God, and then become a nation in full covenant marriage relationship to Him at the Passover time in Egypt. In the 16th chapter of the book of Ezekiel, mark this down, I haven't time to read it. I should take time to, but I won't do it. In Ezekiel chapter 16, God there in the mouth of Ezekiel, he says, I took you out of Egypt, and I found you in Egypt, took you out of Egypt, and made covenant relationship with you at the time of the spring flowers, at the time of love, and I made you my wife. Passover was the time that they got their redemption from slavery, when they became God's wife. And isn't it interesting? Here is a beautiful love story found in the Song of Songs, associated with Passover at the time that Israel, the woman, became God's wife. Who is the bridegroom in this case? It is God Himself. Now, it goes on to say at the end here that how the beautiful relationship is taking place here between the bridegroom and also this woman. And it's a beautiful, beautiful love story. But right at the very end, she says, I have a little sister. Now, she's immature. What's going to happen to her? Well, she's also going to have someone in the future. But then it ends by saying that Solomon took his vineyard, hired it out to others to watch it. He's the kind of, you might say, like a bridegroom. He pays the money to watch for it. And when you put the whole thing together, it says sometime in the future he's going to come back. He's going to redeem his vineyard. And the little sister now will have grown up that she can now become of marriageable age. Now, when you put it all together symbolically, and I'm only going to leave this with you, you'll find that the first woman, Israel, was the one who came out of Egypt. And when she became God's wife, at the time of the spring, when love, you know, would come into blossom and all of that. The Song of Songs here speaks about that relationship. But it also says that a bridegroom is seeing a little sister that's going to grow up, and he is going to let out his vineyard for the bridegroom to watch for, and then at some future date, when the little sister is grown up, he's going to come, and he's going to marry her, too. Now, I wonder what kind of a symbolism we can get out of this. This much I do know. Jesus Christ came on the scene and died at Passover, didn't he? He introduced new covenant at that time. He talked about on the night before the Passover. He talked to his disciples, recorded in Matthew 24, giving prophecies and all of that of the future. Then in Matthew 25, he gave the story of the bridegroom and the 10 virgins and how some are waiting for him to come. And then right at the end of it, he gives this story here about letting out. Let's turn there to Matthew 25 very quickly, because it's most interesting. And it seems to be a clear takeoff on what we find here in the Song of Solomon. In Matthew 25, after mentioning about the bridegroom and the virgins, the 10 virgins, and that certainly fits in with the Song of Songs very well, then he starts in verse 14 by saying, "For the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country, who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. He gave 5 talents to one, to another 2, and to another, according to ability. And he said, go out and do this work, you know, for me." It's very similar to what we find here at the end of the Song of Songs, where this young girl is waiting, you know, to grow mature. But Solomon, what he does is to hire out his vineyard. He's waiting until a particular time, but he's going to come back and he's going to redeem that vineyard. You know, he's going to pay out thousands, he's going to pay out 200s, but when he does it, this young girl will now become grown. Who is this young girl? The first woman was Israel. Is the young girl the second Israel, which we might call the church? Is the bridegroom not really Solomon as it was back here, but Christ? Is that the theme that is being given here? It's possible. If so, then we find that the Song of Songs, speaking about the first marriage between, let's say, symbolically, Israel and God, it also has at the end of it indications of the second, a second type of marriage, becoming with the second Israel and God at a future time. But anyway, we find here the Song of Songs having to do with this marriage. And with Jesus Christ having died on the cross, he introduces for the first time the church, you might say, his bride, into the story. Now, the next festival is Pentecost. Pentecost is held 50 days after Passover, during the day, Sunday during the days of unleavened bread. And in that, on that Sunday, the wave sheaf offering is given, the first fruit. And for 50 days, they harvest the barley, and then finally the wheat. And then at the end of the 50 days, they have the festival of Pentecost. Most people haven't really understood the true significance of Pentecost. Many of us, I don't believe, really have. Even though we felt we've kept the festival for many years, I don't think we really understood it. You know, the First Fruits Festival, that's what it is, Pentecost, First Fruits Festival. But it is a festival which is in honor of the conclusion of the First Fruits Harvest. Not the beginning of the First Fruits Harvest. It's the conclusion of the First Fruits Harvest. The first fruit starts within the days of Passover itself. Who is the first fruit resurrected from the dead? Jesus Christ. There's the first fruit. After that comes other first fruits. And then at the end of the Pentecost, 50 days, you have the Pentecost season, which is in honor of the gathering in of the barley and also of the wheat, called the first fruits harvest. And clearly the first fruits harvest is to do with the church. Now, I have no qualms about that. I think that we find Christian teachings in the Old Covenant law. No question about it. But it's there only in shadow form. It's not there in reality, only in shadow. Well, we find here, then, Pentecost is a festival which is at the conclusion of the first fruits harvest of barley and wheat, with Christ himself being the first sheaf. All right. Now we go to the book of Ruth, and Ruth is in this order. In the original Old Testament. Now, let's see. It's tacked on to Judges back here. So let's turn to Ruth and take a look now at the type of theme that you find in Ruth. Song of Songs was springtime. Well, so is Ruth. But Ruth is late springtime. In fact, this matter of Ruth and Naomi, her mother-in-law, coming back into Judah, into Bethlehem, is all here in the first chapter. But I want you to notice the time of year that they finally got back into Palestine from Moab. Chapter 1, verse 22, at the end of the verse, it says this, "And they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of barley harvest." The beginning of barley harvest. That would put it just near the Passover period, after Passover's over, but near the time when the first sheaf would have been given. Near Pentecost, leading up to Pentecost. All right. Ruth then gleans in the field of Boaz. This is chapter 2. Gleans in the field of Boaz. And she keeps gleaning all during the time of the period of barley and wheat harvest. Go to the end of chapter 2 and verse 23. "So she kept fast by the maidens of Boaz to glean unto the end of the barley harvest and of the wheat harvest, and dwelt with her mother-in-law." This takes us right up to Pentecost. Look at the theme here of this Ruth. Who is this Ruth? Well, she's going to marry Boaz in Bethlehem. Boaz and Ruth have children. And from that union, of course, finally comes David, who becomes king of Israel. And here is this Ruth. She's going through the fields of Boaz, and she's gleaning the barley and the wheat harvest from this field. Now, in the overall teaching of the Bible, the first fruit was Christ himself. The Christian people, church, afterward, first fruits, and the harvest comes in the early springtime. But in the 23rd chapter of the book of Ezekiel, it says that in the corners of any field that was not to be harvested, or in the interior of a field, if there was a sprout left here or a sprout left there or another one left there, people, poor people, could then come into that field by law, and they could take what they needed of the grain to show that all of it could be taken into the baskets and things like that for the poor people to have. This also means that they could come into the corners and they could get all of this grain that was there. And you know, since they were poor people and they needed food to eat for their families and themselves and all themselves, you can be assured of one thing. Every sprig of barley and wheat was gleaned from the entire area here, just absolutely stripped, you might say. Now, who was doing all of this? It was Ruth, according to the story. She finally meets Boaz. Boaz then marries her, and marries her near the end of the barley harvest, you would say probably at the time of Pentecost, somewhere in there. Now, what does this all have to do with the story so far? Well, if the Song of Songs is in the springtime, and we're seeing here a relationship to the marriage of God to ancient Israel, and a reference to a future marriage coming, you know, by the real bridegroom in the future, perhaps we can see the same thing coming out here prophetically with Ruth. And indeed, I believe this to be the case, because Ruth here is no more than, shall we say, the queen mother, who was great-grandmother to King David. David is a type of Christ, and you hear, here you have this mother, this queen mother, in Bethlehem, going through the fields and taking every single bit of the barley and the wheat, and nothing is left for the birds or the animals or anything like that to eat. This queen mother of ancient Israel takes it all. And isn't it interesting? She is a Moabitess. She is not even an Israelite herself. She's a Gentile. But she becomes associated with Israel by the marriage of Boaz. But by this association, it means that even here is a Gentile woman, a queen mother of David, going around getting all of this harvest. But if she's a Gentile doing it, does it not mean that Gentiles perhaps can have a part in this salvation at the end of the age? Because we have a Gentile here, as queen mother, in a sense, taking care of all the little sprigs, the first fruits harvest, reaching up to Pentecost time. The answer is yes. I think there's a prophetic theme that is going out here in this. And just to put it very clearly here, the bridegroom in this case, as far as we're concerned, is Christ. This Ruth here is a member of the Davidic family, formally, of course, putting it all together. So Christ comes along in that too. And we find that Christ died on the cross to become, and by resurrection of the dead, the first fruits of the dead. And then we find the Christian church now becoming the first fruits in the plural. And we find that indication here. But you know, the next festival period to come along is this one here called Abtin, or Lamentations. And Lamentations describes, if you'll look at it, the complete and utter destruction of the city of Jerusalem and also the whole of the Judaic state. Check in Jeremiah 52, and it will explain that the temple at Jerusalem in the time of Nebuchadnezzar was burnt down completely to the ground, and that is when the nation of Judah came to its end and the Babylonian captivity started on the fifth month of Ab in the tenth day of the month. We're told in Chronicles that this Lamentations was ordered, was actually written by Jeremiah 22 years before the destruction of the temple. That's quite true. But it was ordered by Ezra 400 years before the birth of Christ to be read on the anniversary of the destruction of that temple, which is found in Jeremiah, in the illustration of it in Jeremiah 52. Now, it's most interesting that we know that Nebuchadnezzar's temple, the temple in Nebuchadnezzar's time was destroyed on the 10th of Ab, but Josephus tells us something very, very interesting, and I think it has prophetic significance for us today. Today. He tells us that the temple, not of Nebuchadnezzar, but the temple that was in existence in the time of Christ, was destroyed in 70 A.D., exactly on the anniversary of the former destruction in the time of Nebuchadnezzar some 600 years before. In the time of Christ, and in the time of that destruction there in Jerusalem, do you know what all of the synagogues throughout the whole Roman Empire and Parthian empires would have been reading at the very time the temple in 70 A.D. was being destroyed? It would have been the Book of Lamentations. It was as if they had a television set or a radio or something, which they didn't have. But it would have been almost like they would have had that. And here they are reading Lamentations at the very time in 70 A.D. that the destruction of the temple was taking place. Exactly on the anniversary of the time when Nebuchadnezzar did it. Now, why do I say there's probably a prophetic theme coming out here? Well, look at this, and I'm going to rush over it very quickly. If we can see Christ coming out in the Passover theme with the Song of Songs, and I think we can, as first fruit, and we see here with Ruth bringing in the church, shall we say. And when did the church actually start? Acts chapter 2, on Pentecost. You see the significance coming in there. We're in the period of time, if you want to put it this way, from the time of Christ through the church period, and we're in the period when church is the first fruits. But you know, there is something still looming on the horizon. The complete and utter destruction of the Judaic state. And though it happened in 70 AD on the exact date of the anniversary, is there not something in the future still waiting that could be associated with this day here, number 10? It has been known in Jewish history that Ab, the 10th day of Ab, has been a day of infamy almost in all of the Jewish history or Israelitish history. In the time of Noah, even, when he sent out the raven, you know, he sent out a dove, symbol of peace. Then he sent out a raven. That raven, which is a predator, was sent out, if you'll read it very carefully, way back yonder, I mean in the time of Noah, on the 10th of Ab, a predator. And you know, the 10th of Ab, you know how far it is away from the Day of Trumpets, which symbolizes the second coming of Christ, in one way of looking at it, and the resurrection of the dead? It is exactly 50 days away from it. 50 days. And it says that this raven went out and did not come back. And the time that Noah's ark came down and rested on that, where the waters went down, you know, on Mount Ararat, was on the first day of trumpets, when you really look at it. First day of trumpets. So that raven had a 50-day period from the 10th of Ab down to the day of trumpets, which would signify war and destruction and all of that. It's most interesting that this day here is the day which throughout history, and I'm going to write on this one of these days to show the historical references to how many terrible things have happened to Israel or to the Jewish people on that very day right there. And it seems to be indicated all the way back into the flood period, the time of Noah. But we certainly know the two temples were destroyed on that day. Lamentations is to be read on that day. And there were the prophecies of the Bible, both Old and New Testament, says there's going to be tremendous war and destruction on Jerusalem before the second coming of Christ. This time, the second coming of Christ. I am utterly convinced that the theme that is being developed here is not one necessarily of the past, though the significance is there, but it's one of the future. And this Lamentations and this Ab 10 here that we have in association with it is nothing more than a prophetic indication of what we are to look for in the years ahead of us. And this is called design prophecies, design prophecies. That raven went out until the day of trumpets, and that symbolizes the second coming of Jesus Christ back to this earth and the resurrection of the dead. Now, when he comes, that is when peace will finally, through the wars that he will conduct, that's quite true, but finally peace will emerge. And that's when tabernacles period comes on, you might say, which we have called in the past the millennium. It is rather interesting that the book of Ecclesiastes is associated with tabernacles. And it was to be read, it was ordained to be read by Ezra on the Feast of Tabernacles and in association with it. Have you ever read very carefully the 12 chapters of the book of Ecclesiastes? You really should do it in this theme, with this theme going through. Because, you know, it's a time of peace. Solomon's 40 years that he had back there on earth was a time when Israel lived under, you know, in peace, every man under his own vine and fig tree. That 40 years was very, very typical of the 1,000-year period that is going to, it looks like it'll be a 1,000-year period, of course, that will emerge on the earth after the second coming of Christ and after this major war here indicated in Lamentations will be over. And then you're going to have tabernacles, the 1,000-year period. Now, the book of Ecclesiastes, the 12 chapters, speaks about all the glory, the dignity, the wealth, the goodness, and everything that was there in the time of Solomon's life. It's going to be repeated during this 1,000-year period here. But what is the theme of Ecclesiastes? The theme is vanity of vanities, is all of this physical things. You have plenty, you have wealth, you have education, you have buildings all over the place. Solomon mentions it in the first and second chapters. In fact, just a beautiful, beautiful existence. But what he says is all of it is vanity unless you put God into it. And I'll tell you, during the millennium period, which will be for 1,000 years, a time of peace, a time when Satan and his demons will not be around and all of that, when wealth will increase, where knowledge and understanding and all of that will be rampant, beauty, wonderful conditions, everything. You know, that was the same thing that happened at the Feast of Tabernacles when all of the later fruits were on the table, you know, back there in the time of the temple. Still, Ezra the priest ordained that they read Ecclesiastes at that time, because it says in there, all of this of itself, all these physical things are vanity of vanities. And the only thing you really have to pay attention to is to serve God, serve Him, and keep His commandments. That's the thing summed up in a nutshell. But this Ecclesiastes here has to do with the millennial period. And really, during that 1,000 years, one of the best books that you could possibly read for people living at that time, when there's not going to be all this that much trouble around, will be the book of Ecclesiastes. Because it shows all of it is just vanity of vanities. And I happen to know all types of people today that want to build big buildings, want to do this, want to do that, to show how good and beautiful everything is. I would have to say, read the book of Ecclesiastes. It might be nice. It might be good. But you know, it's just vanity of vanities if God is not in it. The last is Purim here. And Esther was the book to be read at that time. And this was the end of the ecclesiastical year. You all know the story of Esther, how almost the Jewish race was almost wiped out. It was going to be completely and utterly destroyed. But by Haman and by his intrigues. But at the last moment, Haman was the one who was hanged on the gallows he had made, you know, for others. And the Jewish people were able to fight against the Persians and others, and they won the battle, and the Jewish race was finally saved. Now, if there is a prophetic theme going throughout this, you have Christ back here at the Song of Solomon with Passover. We have the church coming along with Ruth at the day of Pentecost, and that's the period we're in now. We are expecting the Ab 10 to come along, the great tribulation indicated by Lamentations. After Christ comes back, we'll have Tabernacles showing the thousand-year reign when Ecclesiastes is to be read. But after the 1,000 years, according to the book of Revelation, Satan and his demons will be released from prison for a short time. They'll go up on the breadth of the world, up to Jerusalem. And what are they going to do, according to the 20th chapter of the book of Revelation? They're going out to destroy the saints once more, after the millennium is over. But you know what's going to happen? Ezra put Esther here to be read after Ecclesiastes, to be read after Tabernacles, to be read, by symbolically looking at it, after the 1,000 years. And it's going to be the same thing again. This time, it's going to look like Satan and his demons and the rest and the world will be able to subdue Israel, the new Jerusalem, you might say, or a Jerusalem in Palestine. But the book of Revelation says they're going to be put down just exactly, if we parallel this, as the Jews won complete salvation in the days of Esther. All of it seems to fit together very well indeed. So we have in these five books here, called the Megillot, or the Festival Scroll, prophetic teaching, if we have minds enough to see it. It's a little difficult, a little obscure on the surface. But put together, we've got design prophecies coming out here. And you can find prophecies all over the place. But if I had more time, I would go into this in greater detail. But really, what we have here are the canonizers of the Scripture themselves saying, watch the future. We've got to pass Ab 10 with Lamentations. Then comes Tabernacles with Ecclesiastes. And finally, the Jewish race, Israel, will be completely saved in the end, just as they were saved back there in the time of Esther. Putting it all together, you've got Christ, the church, the Great Tribulation, the Millennium, and then finally, like the book of Revelation says, the salvation of the whole of Israel. All of it is here, just given in perfect design, if we have the ability to see it. I hope that we have eyes to see.